Because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Hey, coach. Before we start the podcast, just wanted to let you know, on May 8th to 10th, I will be partnering with NBA shooting coach Dave Love to put on an exclusive basketball coaching retreat we are calling the Art of Coaching Retreat. In this limited enrollment retreat, Dave and I will share proven concepts that helped us both stimulate coaches from around the world. We will make this experience beneficial for coaches of all levels. The event will be held in beautiful, warm Palm Desert, California, Friday, May 8th to Sunday, May 10th. Go to basketball-retreat.eventbrite.com to get more information, or DM me on Twitter or Instagram, and I will send you the link. Enjoy the podcast.
Coaches, tremendous, tremendous, tremendous opportunity for all of us today as one of my mentors in life, not just basketball, Coach Larry Shiat joins us. Coach Shiat, many of you know, just a Dallas Mavericks assistant coach most recently, but his past in college coaching is tremendous as both head coach at the University of Wyoming twice and Clemson Tigers, and was an assistant coach with Billy Donovan with two national teams as well. And Coach, just a tremendous career, and thanks for taking the time to be able to share the game with us.
Well, I am thrilled to be here, and if there's anybody that's got a little walk of time on his hands right now, it's me. So this is a first, and we're trying to enjoy it here. Before we get started, and this was not practice, but let's talk a little bit about you and Jen and your two young ladies, because I got to be honest with you, you call me a mentor in some way. You are what we all are at least to supposed to be doing. You combine love of family, love of game of life with an absolute love of basketball. And that's what it's supposed to be about. And in the end, when we're looking back, and I'm getting a little closer now age-wise to be looking back, that's what you want people to know you represented. So I mean that from the bottom of my heart, and I wouldn't have spent this hour or plus with you otherwise.
Well, thanks for that, Coach. And just for people, our relationship goes back to when it was pretty easy to be able to call up someone and say, hey, can I work basketball camp? And I was randomly driving out west to do my master's at the University of Victoria. And I was 25, I believe, at the time. And I contacted your office and got a hold of Coach Matt Driscoll. And he said, sure, come out here to Wyoming and work basketball camp. And I ended up working 2 weeks of camp out there, and the relationship started from there. But quite the journey for you, Coach.
A great journey, and one that I probably am proudest of with my 44 years with my best friend and my bride, Pam. We've been together a long time. She's been through 13 homes, a lot of ups, some downs, but we would trade none. And Pam, as well as my family, has always come first. They know that, but not in hours. You know, the hours spent were not even close. But I think maybe less fights, less quarrels, and more time to spend focused on what we could do together.
The hours may not have been close, but the quality of the hours is what matters. Coach, where do you want to start with this podcast?
Let me start out with just a few random thoughts about my background, so at least some of the listeners who don't know anything about me have a better picture going into some of the ideas that I have. First of all, to me, it's what we do and how we do what we do, and rarely what we say or what we tweet. I've always been a guy who felt like he was a wee guy. You know, are you more of a giver or are you more of a taker? And if you think about the people that you know best, it's pretty easy to answer that usually. Maybe somebody with a servant's mentality. And that goes back to, I don't even know if you're aware, I was actually a proud and happy assistant coach 34 years, including those three in the NBA, 30 in college, and only a head coach 11 years. So my perspective is a little different. I never thought, nor do I believe, that I worked for Rick Barnes or Billy Donovan or Rick Carlisle. And I tried to tell those who worked for me during those years, you work with me. But we serve Clemson, or we serve Florida, or we serve the Mavs, all of us included.
Coach, that's great phrasing. We work with our assistants, we work with our head coach, and we serve our institution or our organization. I love that.
Something else I think our players always got tired of me talking about, but it was always about truth-telling. And everybody says honesty is very important. Of course it is. It's not just in court, in basketball. But truth-telling is telling the whole truth. And a lot of us, we leave things out sometimes, maybe because we don't want to fess up, maybe because we don't want to hurt somebody else. But to me, that is maybe the essence of us being the proper mentors and teachers and coaches. Last thought, really, when it comes to at least my past or my profession, look, I'm one of the luckiest guys in the world. I played at a little Division III school. I was not connected with Dean Smith, Bob Knight, or any big time program. And you know what? Was very fortunate, just plodding, grinding, whatever you want to call it. But honestly, I would trade nothing. I always wanted to make sure that I didn't disappoint the people I love the most, my family. You know, even though I pretty much knew I wasn't going to get into the Hall of Fame, I wanted to make sure, like some of my friends, that I would never put them in a position where I was maybe in the Hall of Shame, like some of my dearest friends are today. The last thought before we move on to whatever you're interested in, tell the people that you love, tell them often that you love them. Don't use your thumbs. That's not the same. There's no body language connected when we do that. And I'm constantly telling my three boys that. Did you talk to your mom today? Did you tell your mom you love her? They're in their 30s. Yes, Dad. No. Did you tell her? It takes the same amount of time, but it's way more effective than thumbing. So anyways, I leave you with that. Currently, I think you're aware, I stepped away from the Mavs. I had an opportunity for another contract, but it didn't fit Pam and I.
Well, let's talk about that, Coach. You talked a little bit about the differences off air between NBA and NCAA. Can you share some?
If you've been a head college coach wife, you become mama shy. You're part of the program. The kids are over the house. You bring the dog to practice. You travel with Papa Shy to the games. In the NBA, it was different. If you're a wife of a head coach, assistant coach, intern, whomever, you're clearly just a season ticket holder. And as the 3 years went by, I'm so indebted to Coach Carlisle because he was so kind to me, as was Mark Cuban, but it just didn't fit us. So I'm stepped away the last 3 months. I've read about 30 books. I've flown out 3 or 4 times to a couple different programs, Dayton, University of San Diego. Met with some staffs, watched some teams, spoke to teams, and I hang around the South Carolina area here, go to games at Asheville, Furman, Clemson. One other tidbit here that you might be interested in, you, of course, you know my relationship with Amanda Butler, the new women's coach at Clemson. I had their staff over our lake house here for an 8-hour little basketball get together, as I did the coaching staff. Men's staff at Asheville. This is something that I really enjoy. I don't know what's next, but you know what? I'm enjoying spending some quality time with this young lady.
Let's talk a little bit about the past and the present coaching.
The first thing is, when I got into coaching in the 70s, you had two choices if you're a dumbass like me, and you could be a high school coach or a college coach. The salaries would be much the same. If you're a high school coach, you're going to have to teach, but your summers are off. If you're a college coach, you don't have to teach, but you're going to have to recruit, and the summers aren't off. That was the biggest difference. And uniquely, because the salaries weren't very good in either case, the people who chose to coach were choosing because of love of game and devotion to game and wanted to be maybe what we would call mentors, teachers, you know, fathers of the game, to teach both game of basketball. So that was a distinct difference between now, where the college game has become, it's almost priced itself out by virtue of the money being made and the money being paid by coaches. So it's attracting a different audience. Also, because you didn't have the social media, you didn't even have cell phones. You literally, if you chose, in my case, to coach college, you're in the office from about 7 a.m. till about 7 or 8 p.m. because even if you wanted to make recruiting calls, those had to be made on your 800 number in your office. Whereas you can work and work very efficiently nowadays, for obvious reasons, from your car, from your home, anywhere. That was not the case. Press conferences. I watch a lot of press conferences, both college and pro. It saddens me that almost, I can almost tell you the verbiage, you know, pace, space, threes, analytics, more possessions, culture. And I get it, but it's disappointing to me because in the old days, coach's job clearly was to give your team the best chance to win each and every day. So you definitely had to understand who you got and who they got, who you're playing against. Everybody cannot be advantaged playing the game the same way. It doesn't make sense to me. How could 30 teams in the NBA all say the same thing? Some have different compositions, and all of them have different strengths and weaknesses.
It's such a great point, and it, just because they say it obviously doesn't mean they do it either, but can you give us some examples of playing differently and playing to the strengths of your team?
My example would be years ago, Wyoming. You're at 7,300 feet above sea level. In my press conference, I said I wasn't sure we could attract better talent, innate talent than New Mexico, San Diego State, and Vegas, who all of were at that time top 10 in the country at different times. So I said, we're going to play a little differently. You know, there's two ways to fatigue somebody. You know, everybody said, well, you're going to press, you're going to make people, you know, squeeze oxygen. And I said, well, I think we're going to do that. But, you know, there's other ways to fatigue people. You know, you can fatigue them by making them guard a lot longer. That takes a lot of discipline, and it takes the wind out of your legs. And you also can frustrate people mentally if you play that way, even coaches that you're playing against.
So your personnel should have far more impact on your system and how you choose to play than, let's just say, analytics, which are part of the conversation, but not the whole story.
So in my world, it's who you have and who you're facing, and then make those decisions. Of course, you're going to have non-negotiables that are the paramount in your program, but I've never understood everybody trying to play the same way with different people and different opponents. Think about this. Social media, let's go to cell phones with Generation Y more than anything now. If you replace, just as a thought, Chris, if you replace that cell phone with a bottle of alcohol or pot or some other vice, and you put it at your bedstand all the time, and you walked with it, you drove with it, you constantly had that in your hand, would you think otherwise?
And coach, in your experience, where have you seen over the years the biggest change because of the cell phone and the use of the cell phone?
Locker rooms used to be sacred. High school locker rooms, college locker rooms, pro locker room. And I've been in all of them, unfortunately, lately. And what you see, you could hear a pin drop because there's the headphones and everyone's staring down, using their thumbs. And it's all about me. I'm going to listen to my music. My followers, what I'm interested in. Now think about what a coach's job is. We're trying to bring people together for a we, for a us against them, for something more important than self. So that too has changed. And I don't have the answer. I never, as a head coach, wanted to confiscate a phone. I did want to make sure they understood some advantages and disadvantages of when we have them and when we don't, and how it would affect the whole group. Last thought on Generation Y here. in coaching now because this is a different group. Yes, the why is important. I've heard other people say it. But to me, beyond that, how are you going to get to the why? I always thought, like I would tell our assistants constantly, anything we're doing in our teaching or on the floor, and anything we're doing off the court, we have to support. You can support it with a video and show them why we're doing certain things individually or 3-on-3 or 5-on-5 and show them live segments. Doesn't have to be us, could be opponents, could be anybody. Why are we doing this? And then the last and most important part, besides maybe showing through video, is getting the players to participate, get the input from them, not being afraid. And I carry that one part further. How are you going to handle your staff? I tried in those 11 years to handle the staff the same way. Like, all suggestions are good suggestions so long as you guys tell me why. Just tell me why. In the middle of the game, when I'm spazzing out coaching Wyoming, if you tell me something, I'm going to listen, but you have to tell me why. Otherwise, you know, I'm a dog with no bones. So those are some random thoughts on the game now versus maybe the game when I started, but I still love it. And there's a lot of good.
Well, and that's great to hear, Coach. And I guess getting into some of those practical things, was there anything you did do that helped in the locker room per se to bring it to the type of locker room you wanted or you obviously remember from the past? Were there any things that you did specifically that helped?
Well, I don't know if they helped. I can tell you some specifics. Maybe they relate a little bit to this culture that so many of us talk about. But, you know, Coach Bob Knight, I believed in a lot of what Coach Knight had taught, in particular on the floor. I even read his latest book. It sounds a little crazy, but The Power of Negative Thinking. I give you this as an example. Billy Donovan always used to talk about what impacts winning at Florida, and he would try to get speakers and he would try to give evidence of what factors affect winning. Knight took it a step further, which I did at Wyoming my last 2 years when I thought, you know what, I think we're now pretty good. I think we're as good as those other teams. Maybe not as talented, but I think we're as good. And I felt like, you know what, guys, at the beginning, the very first day of the summer, when all the new players and former players are back, I said, you know what, we're going to go through what a loser looks like, what a loser sounds like, what a loser acts like. We're going to talk about that, going to put it on the board. It ended up being up there for 8 weeks. And the players solicited this. You know, they literally went to the board because my handwriting's not very good. And Nance and Josh Adams, two pretty good players, went up there to represent them. And it came from them, only an occasional coach. I said, before we can talk about or understand winning or winning a championship or being successful, we have to know what goes into losing. Because when the chaos, when the adversity hits, and it's going to hit everybody, it's going to either hit you individually or collectively, sometime during the season. I think Spoelstra always called them shit storms each day, each month. Well, before we can talk about putting together and assembling what this particular team needs to win a championship, we have to know what losers look like, sound like, and act like so that we can at least get away from that or guard ourselves from that, or at least be more intelligent about it. So that was something, we literally had that exercise. Probably had about 16, 17 things, Chris, on the board, pouting, talking bad about a teammate, fleeing, whatever it was that they thought a loser looked like, sounded like, act like, and it stayed up all 8 weeks of the summer.
Yeah, Coach, was that something the players came up with on their own, or was it?
They filled the entire board with thoughts that they had on what losers looked like, sounded like, and acted like.
I was just saying, like, how did you reconnect that during the year?
I can tell you exactly what we did. We left it on the board so that subliminally, those things that they had come up with, that's the only thing they saw the whole summer. They didn't see any plays or any basketball items, not on that board in the locker room. And when the fall came, I said, you know what, guys, we'll keep it in our consciousness because we got to know how to handle it when it happens to us individually or collectively. But now let's talk about success. Let's talk about our team, because we actually were pretty good at that time. And I do think it helped to how much the kids would probably answer better than me. But I do think it helped when we did fall in a rut, when Nance and another young man got mono in the season. That was sort of team-wise and individual adversity when we lost two in a row. So I just wanted us to be aware, hey, it could be your roommate in your apartment. How are you going to handle that? It could be listening to some summer league coach or a family member that doesn't really understand. But this was something that was different for me. We didn't have many slogans and quotes and those things because I never wanted to use anything that didn't have direct input to this particular team. What does this team have to do against the opponents that we know we're going to face? You know, when I first got my first head job at Wyoming and Clemson, it was a passion to improve because I knew where those programs were at that time. And I knew that there was going to be some clubs with far more innate talent. And then when I got back to Wyoming the second time, it was a do. It had to reflect me now that I'm 59 years old and I am who I am. And they're going to have to play for me or it's not going to work. They're going to have to try for me and this program. And if they don't believe or they don't see the man they need to see, it's not going to work. So it was aggressiveness, discipline, and unselfishness. I remember it distinctly. We handed out separately to each kid Webster's definition of aggressiveness, discipline, and unselfishness. Then we read Papa Shy's definition on offense, defense, and game of life. Again, just trying to exhibit, here's who we are, here's who we want to be, here's who we have to be successful. And you know what? It's me. And hopefully you'll get to know it. And to me, you got to show your players who you are, both on and off the court. When you go to the Ronald McDonald House or you go give to a soup kitchen, if the head coach isn't there and or his family, as well as the other coaches, what are you saying? You're saying it's just the players need to be better people, but not the coaches. So those things tie in. Some of these guys call, you know, culture a saying. We had one quote up in all 6 years at Wyoming. One quote, because who I thought we needed to emblemize and who we were. The quote was, I stole some of it from Jeff Van Gundy, a dear friend, and I changed it a little bit to meet us. It said, hard work and intellect will defeat talent when talent doesn't show. My guys got so tired of me saying, hey, guys, you'd be shocked. Football, basketball, baseball, hockey, how many times talent doesn't show. We're going to be there. We're going to get there. Hard work, and especially you show me a smarter woman or a smarter man in anything, sales, business, basketball, they can make up a lot of ground. And that's how we wanted to win a championship. That's how we wanted to be as successful as we could be at Wyoming. And you know what? Down the home stretch, we were pretty good.
Oh, absolutely. And you had tremendous success there in that part of your career and throughout, obviously impacting the game. So, Coach, I mean, you talked a little bit about culture and you talked about it in terms of knowing what people are going to say in press conference. Is it just that we feel that we have to say that word as coaches because that's what people expect from us as coaches, that we have to throw around this word culture? What does it actually practically mean for your team is what's more valuable, right?
Yes, you said it as well as anybody else could. I think it's being forced as pace and space. You know, it's different for everybody. The thing that comes back, again, I know my guys got tired of me saying it all the time, but, you know, when no one's around, that's who you really are. If you want to have a culture, you have to be the culture. you, the head coach and the staff. And that's where you can slip up on those character ledgers. When no one's around, that's who you really are. You got to match what you do, not what you say you do. And that's why I didn't like some of the slogans or whatever. We're going to teach them how to cut the nets down the first day we're there. Wait a second. Let's wait until we really think we're going to be around the corner. I did it once. I did it once almost by accident. We actually, thank God, Nance, the year we did win the championship, go to the NCAA, he was finally over his mono. We were getting ready for the Mountain West. No one knew in the gym that I had said, look, depending on how we practice, I just got a feeling. I think we're pretty close on this thing. We got to run the table. We don't have to win four in a row, but we're going to have to win three. So I said, after our rebounding drill, I told one manager, if I look at you, go, because everybody will be looking at me. I'll be down the other end. Go get a ladder. Go get a scissors. And what I did was, I not only did what some others have done in the past, but I sort of waited until I knew we're close. I didn't want to be 5 years away with a dream and a thought that may never exist. Hey, we're pretty close. We're pretty good. So I said, guys, we're not just going to cut the nets down. We're going to take them with us to Vegas. You each are going to have one little strand. If you want a longer strand and you want it to have more meaning, you'll know what to do. You're there. And I constantly told them, look, you're going to have to win without your coach. Great teams win without their coach. The volume goes up. 20,000 people there, maybe more. It's pretty loud. You're not looking at your coach every single decision. You're going to play on your instincts, on your practice, and for each other. And almost every day at practice, they would hear me say that. Hey, guys, you're not going to hear me sometimes. So the shit we're doing here counts because it's going to be on you. I'll help every way I can. And so those are some things, at least culture-wise, you have to show to your guys why it's important to have a cause greater than yourself, how good of a feeling it is when you do things for others. You can show them through books. You can show them through video. But the best way to show them is how you act, how you present yourself. And so telling the truth, as I said early, like telling the whole truth, well, you have to be able to do that. And you have to be able to accept it. One last thing on culture, because this was down the end of my career in college at Wyoming. You know, I was already 60. And so you're coaching 18, 19-year-old kids. There's a little bit of a gap there. Would you agree, Chris?
Agreed.
So I felt like I have to be in a position that they feel at least comfortable enough, maybe threatened sometimes, but comfortable enough that they really want to play for the old guy, because it's just not going to work otherwise. You know, you got to understand, when we get into some of the differences between the NBA and college, there are some vast differences. But one of those, which has to do with culture, is, are you going the extra yard? Like, are special situations, ball screen D and underneath out of bounds, offense and defense, is that actually more important than teaching them time management, teaching them to be on time, teaching them how to address young ladies and handle that, teaching them how to be helpful? Those are things in the college game, and those are things for an older coach at that time. I had to make sure they understood, this guy actually cares about me. This guy actually believes in my future. This guy is going to want to get a phone call from me, which I still love on the weekends once in a while, when you hear from a former player, maybe sending a picture of their kid or bragging about this or making fun of the way I talked, whatever it was. But this is what I thought was the essence of really having culture, or pretending.
Such good points throughout. And I guess I'm curious, going into the piece about the two different games, the NCAA and the NBA game.
I mean, the talent difference between the players is obvious, but is there a blending of things from the NBA to the NCAA and vice versa that can help both games?
Yes, we can blend, and I can throw out a few similarities and a few differences. But the biggest difference is we're coaching young men in college. We're coaching men in the NBA. The best talent, certainly the best offensive talent in the world, which is incredible. But the talent has a lot to do with, geez, it's a little lower scoring or it's a little less exciting. Well, that's because we're used to seeing on TV every night, 11 or 12 channels, the best players, certainly the best offensive players in the world. First of all, I would say this. Here's one I don't even know if you've ever thought of. It occurred to me, unfortunately, the tough way. I'm now with the Dallas Mavericks for 3 years. You know, the better your team does in college, the better opportunity you have for better players in the future recruiting. The poorer your team does in the pros, the better your team has to get the next top lotteries. Now, that is a total dichotomy there. I mean, and that's why 8 to 10 teams, you can understand why they are at least attempting to play, but perhaps not to win. And that's completely different. Against every core I've ever been taught, there's never been a college game played that they weren't trying their very hardest, maybe too hard sometimes. Another difference is in college, every team, despite how bad or how much adversity they've gone through, has a chance to win the national championship in March. Every team, whether it's a conference tournament or whether it's an automatic bid, every team. And that's not the case in the NBA. Financially, Chris, it's unbelievable to me because I lived in a college world for 40 years. They were like, the lowest paid guy was millionaire. And 8 or 9 of these guys were making more than, clearly, Coach Carlisle is going to be in the Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Fame coach. I think there were like 7 or 8 players making more than him. Now, that is a difference. Regardless of how much not good stuff's going on with people being paid in college, that's a difference.
Really interesting perspectives. Is there something else that stands out?
My biggest difference, if you ask me for my biggest difference between the college and the pro game, was I felt and enjoyed thinking that I could have, hopefully a good one, but I could have a huge impact on their future, whether it was game of life or ball. And I didn't feel quite that way in the pros. I felt like I could help. And the great ones, in no different than college and pro, the great ones want everything they can get. And there's a different motivation. You know, the more you win in college, we prove that to Joe Kim and Al and Corey and Torrey and even Chris Richards, who I think averaged 6 points a game, got drafted 40th. The more you win, the more good things can happen in college for you individually. So your team, that's important. In the pros, I did not see the correlation with how much money you could make as far as how good your team did during the regular season or in the playoffs. I saw the correlation between analytics and your numbers and how much you could be worth. And for me, that was disappointing because I loved thinking I could have an impact on these guys.
Is there a basketball difference that stands out to you? People certainly talk about the defensive rules.
The biggest difference basketball-wise, if you would say just specifically, what's the biggest difference basketball-wise, is the 2.9 rule. I mean, in college, it does still, and I know I'm way behind the times, but it excites me to know that if Dean Smith wants to go 4 corners, you better be ready. If Syracuse wants to play 40 minutes of zone, you better be ready. If Shaka wants to press, run and jump the whole game, you better be ready. If Shai wants to make you play 3 sides of defense to either tire you or make the first mistake, you better be ready. And if you want to play pace and space because you got, you know, Duke's, I guess they're bringing in 5 one-and-dones every year now, then you know what? You better be ready. In the NBA, because of the rules, every rule I came across, I don't know them all in 3 years, but every single rule aided the offense. Because the desire to get 40-point games, triple-doubles, double-doubles, 120, 130, 140, that clearly is a difference.
Definitely a difference. And again, both games, I mean, you talk to people, they like certain, sometimes they like the NBAs, like college. I mean, personally, I love basketball. So it's great to be able to watch basketball, but obviously there's ways to be able to improve all of the games that we watch. And I know you have a different approach a little bit to preparation and teaching. Can you share some of those ideas with us around prep and teaching that you found successful?
Yeah, I do. I'm going to divert for 1 second, though. Just a little advice to young coaches. If, you know, a lot of times when I go speak, coach, what advice would you give a young coach? Besides my love of the college game, it's more so the 250, 260 that are really basically coaching as I knew it. 4 or 5 years, a young man's going to be there. He's going to get a degree. He's going to prepare for life. He should be a better basketball player if we did our job, but he most certainly should be a better man, better husband, better father, and better community figure down the road. I would advise, if there was, again, there's only one thing, coach, how can I prepare better for the future? Look, every day as a head coach, I spoke to our team. Never once can I remember speaking to them without thinking about it, writing it down, and preparing some thoughts. Speak. That's the most important thing. There's Rotary Clubs, Kiwanis Clubs, Optimist Club. They all are looking for speakers, and assisting coaches need to learn to get up in front of people, talk from the heart, show this culture or values or love of game. And that is the best practice I could give a young assistant or an older assistant who had not been a head coach. Because when that day comes, you know, there's an old saying, every time a young man or a young lady opens their mouth, the one thing you can be sure, are they or aren't they educated? You can tell that. So that would be my one piece of advice.
Coach, I love that. And one of the most popular things I've ever posted is a blog from some of your notes preparing for a head coaching position. And it's got over 200,000 views. And I know there's so many people so excited and passionate about coaching that they're always looking for, you know, little advice, little ideas like that. So that's tremendous. That's really good stuff.
Hey, Chris, just so you know, it didn't pay off too much. I was an assistant 24 years before I got my first head job. I want to say 17.
But that's the point, isn't it? Isn't that the point, right? That you prepared every day with that opportunity in mind, whether it was going to happen or not? I'm sure you prepared like you were going to be a head coach.
No, 100%. And sometimes things go quicker than you'd like, and sometimes they don't. But honestly, some of the most wonderful years, seasons, or days I ever had coaching were as an assistant. My teaching thoughts are a little different, probably, than some, and that's okay. First of all, I'm a whole part whole guy. So what's that mean? First day of the summer. All the guys just got there. It's June 11th. We're going to wrap up a piece of a t-shirt with adhesive tape around there so we don't break the rule with a ball. But we're going to go down on the court, and it's going to be some leisure time. We're going to talk about the entire defense because that's my MO. That's my DNA, and that's got to become ours. Again, it was who we are. I might not have done that if I had Noah Horford, Brewer, Green, and Humphrey, but we didn't. And so we're going to show the whole first. I know you've talked in the past, and you do such a good job now with a new teaching methodology, one-on-one and then three-on-three. Well, you know what? Before we play one-on-one, I'm going to show them why, and I'm going to show them how it fits.
Well, so Coach, can I just stop you there for 1 second?
Yes.
I am 100%. No, and all the evidence-based literature supports what you're saying. So what you saw me present is the individual skill development component of it, which is still offense versus defense. But presenting the whole, it is the most important part, because what I share with people is that if you don't connect the why, but the why in terms of perception and decisions. Like when you go to do the parts, they don't know what you're talking about if you don't connect the whole.
I couldn't agree more, and it always made sense to me. And even if you'd have told me that the science or the analytics or any of that other crap didn't support that, if it didn't make sense to me, how could I bring that to the table and pretend? Kids can figure that out. They're going to know Shai's pretending. So, no, I was a firm believer, like, let's say at the Mavs, because in the pros, they put in 5, 6, 7 either actions or counters on a daily basis. And I always, before they broke them down, I said, let's just show it to them. Let's just show it to them, even if it's 60, 90 seconds. You know, if this shit goes good, this is what it's going to look like. And then maybe throw a couple interns on D so they got a feel, so it's not five against nobody. The other team's actually going to have five bodies out there. But anything, one-on-one, three-on-threes, any drill that we were going to use, we were going to show video or show on the floor, literally, why we were doing this and how it's going to operate in the real game. So that's a difference with some. I would never start a practice with, for example, breakdown station. Even if I had to spend just 2 minutes showing the whole first, then let's go to stations. Maybe it's old fashioned, but to me, it made sense.
No, it's 100% great stuff. And I share this at all the clinics I do now, which is 5-on-5 slow learning is better than 5-on-0 fast learning, which takes it even a step further than what you're saying. But there's more value to players being able to connect those ideas that you talked about before you do the break.
Yep. By the way, we were on the college subject, and I wouldn't mind throwing out a couple things about staff here while we're on staff or young coaches.
Of course.
But I can tell you, if you're a college basketball coach at any level, I'm a firm believer, because you're talking to a lifetime assistant guy too. But your academic person, your trainer, and your strength coach are the three people who will end up spending the most time with your team when their guard's down. That's important. When the assistants are with them, no matter how buddy-buddy or how they recruited them or how much they love them, like them, respect them, the guard's up, their coach, certainly the head coach. But your academic trainer and strength person are in valued positions. They are very important. And if you're a young coach, it might serve you better to either put more money or to get them, not, you know, don't get the linebacker from the football staff to be your strength coach. It is really important, because those people not only have to be on your same page and know your values and your non-negotiables, they also have to be intelligent enough to know what to share, what not to share. And again, they serve Wyoming. They serve Clemson. They don't serve me, but they are important. And one other thing on its staff, and I learned this because I was very fortunate to work for all three, Gary Colson, Rick Barnes, and Billy Donovan, three tremendous coaches, three coaches that do things almost 180 different. So you got to figure out down the road who you are, but they always made me, so I always implored our assistant coaches, do exactly what I'm doing, because I was a little anal when it came to prepping. Like, I would be months out front thinking, okay, who are we? Who are we playing? What do we got to do that fits us best? I can't put signs up if they don't relate to who we are and the task we have. But if it was our culture, what rules or standards we were going to have, what vocabulary we were all going to use, our drill book, our syllabus of how we're going to get in and what we're going to get in and when. You know, every college professor by law has to hand out a syllabus to its students. But you know what? As a coach, by law, you should be handing that out. And you should be organized enough to know, when are you going to teach what on O? When are you going to teach what on D? And when are you going to teach what in special situations? And then every off day, you better go reflect, because you might have not got in what you wanted, or they may not have yet perfected what you wanted. That at least those are some of the things that I would say, guys, do this. Papa Shai's not going to be here forever. You're going to be sitting in this chair. Do what I'm doing. If you're not comfortable saying it, write it down. Give it to me as a note. But let's talk about it. Let you prepare your own information. And then let's compare it to mine. You trust me now. That's why you're here. So those are the types of things as a staff I liked. I probably inherited from Barnes and Donovan more than anybody, because those guys were nuts when it came to asking questions and accepting suggestions.
This is so valuable, all the different thoughts. And if we jump all over the place, that's the point of this podcast. It's really a stream of consciousness that you're sharing about us improving.
All right, Chris, let's jump somewhere else then. You ready for
this? Let's
do it. There's more guys and more young ladies listening to your podcast that are have-nots than haves. I mean, how many Dukes and Kentuckys are just going to acquire 5 one-and-dones every year? So no matter what, they have 5 one. I mean, there's just not that many of us. Okay. So if you're one of the have-nots, just a random thought. I remember in one of my idols was, and still is, Hubie Brown. It's incredible, his basketball IQ. But he always used to talk about, you know, when you're setting up your year, you have to set it up two ways. One is you have to know how you're going to defeat the top two, maybe three teams in your league. And second of all, you have to find out how you're going to be best in March. Well, if you're a have not, I'm not buying. And I love them. I'm not buying at all. I'm selling. Because if you're at Wyoming or Clemson, let me tell you something right now. You better make sure you beat who you need to beat. And maybe take the role of the underdog and knock off, like we were lucky once and knocked off number one, or I think we had 11 top 10 wins at both Clemson and Wyoming. My point was, you got to beat who you got to beat. And my other point was, that's why I'll tell you what we did out west in a second. You better not wait for March if you're one of the have-nots, because it's not this metric system or whatever the hell they got now in college. That's not going to work. If you're in the ACC, you're going to get 15 high loaders. If you're in the Mountain West, you're going to get one high loader. Even if you schedule 5, you're 10 behind. So to be honest with you, day one, game one, that's the most important game. And I hope we're in good shape in March, but I know one thing. It's not going to be equal. Duke may not get knocked off 4, 5, 6 times. They're going to still be in the dance with a high number, not Wyoming and Clemson. So I never bought into those two things. And I didn't want our team to ever reflect that. That's sort of why we took the ambiance of, you know, aggressive, disciplined, and unselfish. And this is what I did, as crazy as it sounds. Those last couple of years when I knew, hey, you know what? We may not have the total talent. We're pretty good. We can beat these guys now. Not maybe. And so I flipped it. You know, summer, they changed the rules and you were allowed to practice if you wanted to practice, but do individual offensive improvement or individual defense improvement. Well, guess what? Papa Shai told the team, here's the deal. We're actually pretty good, guys. We got a chance to be better than pretty good. But we're at 7,300 feet. Here's the deal. I'm not an idiot. I know all you guys. You have your own guy. You do your 500 shots, or you want to beat somebody, do 1,000 shots. You got your runners and your floaters. And I get it. But you know what? You're going to do that. You don't need the assistance and Papa Shai to help you do that. You're going to do that no matter what. You love doing that. It's amazing how many guys work on individual offensive improvement, either all year in the offseason. And then the coach walks in, September 28th and says, to win the championship, we got to defend and rebound. Well, no shit. Why didn't you work on that for the other 6 months or at least half the time? So here's what we did. I said, no one is going to be on the floor with any of the coaches or Papa Shai in the summer for these 8 weeks unless it's full practice. We're going full bore. We're working an offense and defense, an individual offense and individual defense. And furthermore, we're going to compete our tail off conditioning because we're at 7,300. When we get back in the fall, we're a little closer to games. We're a little closer where we can't afford injuries and illness because of who we are. Then there'll be plenty of time for a little more of our individual offensive expansion. And that's what we did those last two summers. Would I do it everywhere? Maybe not. But you know what? There is an importance of the mental part. And subliminally, I knew our guys knew, hey, right off the bat, we got to be like a bolt. We got to be aggressive, disciplined, unselfish right off the bat. We can't wait.
Coach, the key part about that, I totally agree, is that there's this fear of practicing or conscientiousness about workload management, all these different things. And I do think flipping the script, so to speak, flipping the seasons and practicing in the off season more so that you can manage workload more within the season and focus on mental health, physical well-being, obviously confidence building, all these different things that are so important when you get to gameplay. I mean, this concept, I believe, is the modern approach to player development. And too often in the offseason, they do the same thing. They do their block shooting drills with their trainer or on their own. And then in season, they do their block shooting drills with them or on their own. So it's like they never get game reps anymore. So I think what you did is absolutely brilliant.
Well, you're singing to the choir, but yep. The old guy was maybe not intentionally trying to be the young guy. It just made sense to me. And I the first to admit, I don't understand a lot of numbers. Let's get to numbers for a second. Let's get to stats for a second. Let's get to analytics, which I don't even know how to spell. But I can tell you this. Those non-negotiables is what came to play. And so the guys have to not only inherently understand what we're trying to tell them, we have to prove it. We have to show the why. So these last 2 years, I've done a lot of research in the teams that had, and I had to pick out those analytics or stats that helped us, Wyoming, who we are, who we're going against. And so it seemed to me that the teams that had held people for defensive DER, defensive rating, of 0.85 in the pros, you could never do it under one, but in college you could. They finished first or second in their league. If they did that and they got more than 80% of the defensive rebounds. Now, I thought we could do that because I place a lot of thought. I mean, a lot of emphasis on the first 6 and last 6 seconds of every possession, trying to take away the first layup and three, the first one, and trying to make sure that we get over 80% of defensive rebounds. I thought no matter what, because a lot of that's based on heart and intellect more than talent. So those are the only two stats. I'll give you an example. Let's say you're playing 4-on-4 or 5-on-5. You're playing live at practice. So we scored like everybody else. But here's the deal. We always kept DER and defensive rebounding percentage. So we're playing 5-on-5. Maybe we usually put minutes because when we play games, we have to play minutes. We don't play up to points anymore. So we play 5-minute game. At the end of 5 minutes, the gold team beat the brown team. They beat them 13-11. Guess what? Matt was yelling at the top of his lungs. I'd yell, yo, Matt, what was the gold's DER? 0.8. Great, they got it. What was their defensive rebounding percentage? 85%. They got it. How about the brown team? And that would determine, because if both teams, I don't care if one of them won the game, if both teams didn't meet that, they're both running. Because you did not meet the most important standard. Every time we played, that's anything live, that's what we kept. DER and defensive rebounding percentage. And the only two things Dane Papashai was going to look at offense were, I got a lot of assistants that look at a lot of numbers because they're smarter than me. But the only ones I was going to look at, because I thought, again, they were controllable factors, free throw attempts, free throws made, that was one. Every day and every game, and turnovers. Not assist turnovers, because the same passes, and Luka figured this out with the Mavs 2 years ago, the same passes he threw night after night, sometimes Hardaway and Brea made them, and sometimes they didn't. Often the same pass, they could pass. So it was turnovers, turnover percentage. That was it. No other stats would I allow them, at least from me, to hear. Now, they'd see, you know, because you know as well as I do, there's a whole lot of them. Those I thought were controllable. Those I thought fit the Wyoming ado, aggressive, discipline, unselfish. And I was pretty certain we could get that done. And, well, and you're going to ask me whatever you want from now on. We did.
No, it's good. Yeah, you did. And that it showed in success. And it's obviously part of the identity and part of what your players probably valued. And I imagine they started to ask without you even telling them for those numbers.
No question.
They valued the success. Yeah.
And at halftime, you know, I might see, you know, one guy's pissed or pouty because the game's not going good for him. We all get that. Not going to scream at him. Papa makes mistakes too. But one thing for sure, the common denominator was they would want to know those four things, just those four, not 9, not 11, not 16, those four things. And I wanted to show them more than anything. I know this sounds crazy, but like everybody's going to have 5, 6, or 7 games in college, probably in the pros, it's damn near 15, 20. They're going to have 5, 6, or 7 bad shooting nights. They shoot 34%. I want our guys to know on those 5 or 6 games, we got a heck of a shot to win. Here's why. We can still win. It may be brutal. It may be ugly. God dang, we won the Mountain West Championship to go to the NCAAs and cut the Nets down. We won 45-43, and Reggie Miller did the game, and he killed me damn near most of the game. I get it. But you know what? Against San Diego State, I thought that's the best shot we had. They're going to make a mistake before we make a mistake. They're going to have to play 3 sides of the ball. My guys before the game would walk up to opponents and a lot of times say, hey, guys, I hate to tell you, you can tell your coach this too, you're not getting your touches tonight. You're not getting your points and rebounds because you know what? You're going to have to guard a little longer than you want. And they liked it. Great. They bought in, thank God.
No question. Led to great success in those years. And coach, transitioning a little bit, because I know it's something that you can add some insights to as well, is that do you have some favorite things, some favorite drills, some favorite things you did? You already talked about whole part in terms of teaching, but were there some other favorite aspects of practice that you felt translated best for your team?
Let's go to 2 again. The 2 that I would say, because to me, that the beginning of a practice, are really important, as would be the beginning of a game and the end of a game, beginning of the half and the end of the game. So, yes, the start of every practice, we always, Al Edwards was my assistant, who's now the head coach and great guy, and he would start them. Everybody would line up. You've probably seen the drill before. We got to the point where it only took us 75, 80 seconds. Everybody's going to take a charge. And we did it, you know, you reacted to the ball was passed to either the foul line or the 2 off corners, short corners. And then the guy would step up and take the charge quickly. Boom. Next guy. We'll wipe the floor so it's not wet. And if Nance wasn't practicing because of the ACL or Riley wasn't practicing because of a concussion, somebody's got to take 2 that day. Because we got to take 1 for our buddy. That's how practice started every day, including game day. And Papa Shy took it at the NCAAs. They all lined up for that one. Because I, again, subliminally, a message. This is who we will be. And we led the league 5 straight years in attempted and taken charges. Then we went to the most important part of the game to me and the game that's changed, transition D. And we spent a lot of time. They understood until I know the gym smells right. You know, I'd always talk about hands, feet, mouth. And, you know, good teams do 2 of them, but the great teams use their hands, their feet, and their mouth. And so we'll decide. I am not moving on from transition D until I am certain I like the smell of the gym. And if you know what I mean, you know exactly what I mean by the smell of the gym. It's got to be loud. It's got to be urgent. You know, forget this thing. I want my team to play hard. Well, what's play hard? I want an edge. I want to see head turners on defense looking for ball man, ball man, ball man. I want to hear the biggest guys because they're usually closest to the basket and can see everything. The little guys are blind to ball screens and off flares. I want them to be the loudest on D, and then I want my littles to be the loudest on O because they see it all.
Were there any drills that stand out to you as being the most important for developing transition defensive concepts?
So we worked on transition D, a variety of drills, and they're probably hard to discuss here, but we weren't moving on. It could be 4 minutes, it could be 14 minutes until we did what we did. You asked me the last time we were together at the Summer League in the NBA, is there anything you would do maybe different facing how you were playing now, you know, how people are playing offense? And the one thing I thought was, in those first 6 seconds, any screen, even if it's a rub, any screen I'm switching. And I didn't do that in college before. Whatever our ball screen D was, that's what we did the first 6 seconds. But now, because that quick three or that quick throwback three is becoming such an important part, that would be the one change I would make in those first 6 seconds. And then once we had the ball contained and we were into half court O or half court D, whatever you want to call it, then we would go with whatever ball defense we were using or how we had operated to defend that particular game, maybe personnel driven.
Coach, before you go on from that, that's fascinating because one of the things I wanted to follow up when you talked about transition defense was this concept of defending the three-point line in transition, which is obviously a huge priority nowadays. Were there any little insights from the NBA that you learned about defending the three-point line in transition? You talked about switching within the first 6 seconds. Anything else?
There weren't too many because I got to be honest with you. The greatest shot makers I have ever seen, the greatest shot makers in the world, and they're not shooting from the three anymore. The better 20 or 25 NBA shooters are now shooting from two steps beyond and or step backs from two steps beyond. So the only thought was the load is still really important. The load takes care of the layup and the foul and forcing skips. But the load can't be quite what Papa Shai thought in college in the NBA. What I mean is if J.J. Redick or Seth Curry or, like I said, 25, 30 guys are running on the opposite wing in the NBA, instead of being at that midline, there's no way because you're not going to get there. And they can park it on that opposite wing. They can park it from 28, 29, 30 feet. In fact, Mark Cuban has our guys, especially in the summer, and had our player development guys working a lot on seeing if we could establish further depth in our threes. And just because that's where the game has gone, I felt like I knew Milwaukee. I'm trying to think of who else. They're still loading. They're still trying to play against the free throw and the layup. And they're trying to take the three away, but they're so talented. And the rules so help the offense in the NBA that you can't take both away.
Yeah, good point. Good point in terms of that. And I interrupted you as you're going on to another drill and another thing that you
yeah,
like.
The only other drill, it's not a like, it's a love. It's the end of practice. And for years, guys have talked about how you're going to end practice. You're going to bust their ass. You're going to make them laugh. You're going to put them on the line to run. I like this because, first of all, we weren't going to punish. And we were going to try to do something as a group. And the most important offensive item that at least my guys knew were getting to the line, making them. I get the importance of routine and confidence and make 100 or take 50. You don't get 50 in the game. You don't get routine in the game in terms of repetition. You get routine for your 3 seconds and your one free throw, first half or second half. Everybody thinks that the one at the end of the game lost the game. Why didn't the three in the first half that three different guys miss three different free throws? Why didn't that affect the game? So this is called 6-7-8. I stole it, and then I changed a little bit of it from Tim Miles, who is a great coach and a finer person, and hopefully going to get back in as a head coach next year. But 6, 7, 8. So you put the clock, you know, we all got together, practice. They know practice is over in terms of the exhaustion. Now the most important part of offense, there's no talking, no managers, no assisting coaches, not the head coach and not one player. We've already changed the environment. There's total silence. And been silence all day, unless our defense sucked. So it's total silence. Scoreboard's on. Put 2 minutes and 30 seconds on the clock, and it's going to go on when the first guy shoots. We're at four baskets. Let's say there's two at a basket or three at a basket if you have 12, 13 guys. Okay? So one player's at the foul line at each basket with a ball, and one or two are there just rebounding. We're going to shoot foul shots. We got to make six in a row, one at a time at each basket. The player one shoots at basket one. As soon as he's finished, player two shoots at basket two. As soon as he's finished, player three shoots at basket three. And then when we get back to basket one, one of the two guys that didn't shoot that was rebounding, he's up next. And it goes pretty quick. We got to make six in a row. Then we got to make seven in a row as a team. Then we got to make eight in a row. In 2 minutes and 30 seconds, keeping your routine, you can't rush, no talking, scoreboard's on. So basket one, shooter one, he makes it, put a one up. Basket two, shooter two shoots it, makes it, put a two up. Basket three, the third shooter shoots, misses, put a zero up. And as the numbers go up, the sphincters get closed. And guys start looking. They start looking around the gym. Uh-oh, I'm going to be number six. Uh-oh, I'm going to be number eight if these next two go in. And you know what? It's the closest thing to dramatically giving only one shot, which is what you get in a game. Little pressure on. Everybody's watching. No talking. We change the atmosphere. And we got to get this done by 3 minutes. So, Chris, one last thought. If Mama Shy at Wyoming, we took the evening practice because I like the women's coach, but I wanted more for our guys to eat right. So if the cafeteria was closed, which it was at the end of our practice, then we had to get the best restaurant in town to deliver. So it worked out good for us. But it's still rough, 7 o'clock now.
Yeah.
It's still 7 or 7:15. So if Mama Shy, if I knew she had dinner waiting, I'd tell the guys when we started, all right, guys, we got four tries to get it today, meaning it's not going to take us more than 10 minutes. But if Mama Shy didn't have dinner waiting, we're doing it till we get it. Sometimes that took one time. Sometimes that took six or seven times. I was in no hurry. No one's going to get hurt. And by the way, we kept free throws when our guys shot 25 or 50 or 100 or weekends or summer. We kept free throws, but we also kept pressure free throws when we were in 6, 7, 8 or when we were in games. And I got to tell you, the average was 10% or greater. The difference between, you know, I got 89. Yeah, I got 92. Well, when you shoot pressure free throws, why are you shooting 78? And I think it gravitated to the point that they at least understood in the first half that free throw is a valuable commodity. And that's why they call it a free throw. Nobody can get in your way. And there's no question you can get relaxed, or you can at least get in a position where you know you can make it under pressure, because we practice that every day. That was my favorite.
Well, it creates an emphasis, as you're saying. Like, you value them, we value them, and this is what we're going to do to be able to help us be successful. So, Dre, now what I'm curious about, do you know the numbers in terms of the correlation between the practice attempts and field goal percentage?
Yeah, the average for the team was greater than 10%, somewhere between 10 and 12%. But some guys didn't slip as much as others. I mean, some guys.
So that was the variance?
A great deal.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And they understood. And once they saw, you know, it's like anything else. If you see a pattern. So once they saw after 7, 8, 9 practices, or maybe 9 practices and 3 games, and they saw that percentage. You know how guys shoot free throws all the time, especially in the summer, individual times during the day, and they get 100 up. The scores are absurd. And I know they're not trying to cheat, but they weren't close. And I was sort of glad they weren't close, and that I was still praying we made them in the games. And remember, again, you try, at least I try to use a quote that matches who we are and who they are. And so why was this so important? Well, Riley Grabo for two straight years led the nation at free throws. His senior year, he shot 96%. Josh Adams, who they were going to foul next and had the ball a lot, shot high 80s. And Larry Nance, who didn't quite get the ball, but he was certainly our go-to guy, he was in the 80s. So fortunately, it was something that I knew was important. Our style of play knew that it might even be more important for us in lower scoring tight games. And I actually thought it was controllable because it didn't matter how much talent the opponent had. They can't guard us there.
Well, and another huge part about that is I agree with what you're saying. Block free throw, like mass free throws over and over, it doesn't correlate to game free throws at all. It's proven time and time again. But what the key part about what you're doing there is you're practicing the psychology of shooting the free throw, the coping strategies, the routine.
Yes.
The psychology is really what needs to be practiced more than the actual physical action of shooting a free throw.
Yeah, and we talk about it every once in a while. Hey, why aren't you comfortable? I mean, we do this every day. You're not comfortable because the environment changes. And guess what? In the pit at New Mexico with 17,000 trunks, the environment's going to change there too. So let's just do what we always do at the end of practice and show your routine quickly and knock it in. And I might not have said that if I had, a bunch of bricklayers, but we actually had pretty good free throw shooters.
Well, it's the right thing to say too, because you're connecting practice to performance, right? Like what this is the same, they're the same thing, but obviously the environment's different.
Yeah, Chris, one other thing about fouls and the significance, good guys, especially if the bad guys on the other team, if they're good players, if they foul, they don't get to play as much. So, and I constantly say, hey, guys, you want to get the talent level a little equal? Let's get a couple of those guys sitting on the bench because either they couldn't or they didn't want to guard long enough because, again, hard work and intellect will defeat talent when talent doesn't show. And I say all the time, hey, guys, you'd be shocked how often the most talent doesn't show. Or, you know what, think about our college game, because it kills me. Kentucky forever had the best guys, forever. But Duke was probably my heart and soul. The greatest pride I had, I mean, I was an ACC coach, and I probably wasn't ready to be a head coach at that time. But I got to tell you, Carolina and Duke in those days, for the most part, especially in the 70s and 80s, their guys went to school 3, 4, 5 years. They had degrees, real degrees, not sociology for 90 hours. And it kills me in my heart. Duke is the best example because I love them. But they would be 29-4 no matter what, and always were, with guys going to school for more than 6 months and guys getting degrees and staying there 3, 4 years. And even if they had to play against an occasional guy that they had, I get you're going to have a guy that's just so good that goes. But when we get to the point that the only thing we're doing is having some college teams have 4, 5, or 6 one-and-dones who clearly have made a statement, I'm going to come on campus for 6 months only. That's not good. No matter what Billis says, that's not good. I mean, that's why maybe the breakaway is not far in the distance.
Well, and Coach, you've done an exceptional job bringing attention to so many issues that I wasn't aware of for someone who's immersed in basketball at the Florida Clinic, coaching clinic, where it's not just X's and O's, and it's showing other parts of the game, other parts of leadership, other parts of being human. And just tremendous things like that that come through those insights about the game. And do you want to talk about that quickly, how much you value that it's not just a coaching clinic, that it's more than the X and O?
Yes, it is. And it always will be for me. And so the message that I like to send, why I like to continue that, look, that clinic has taken a completely different personality. Actually, one of the originals in our group, you know, he was offended. Shai, you've changed this. It's not what it used to be. He's right. Originally, it was only 12, 13 guys from different conferences getting together and comparing notes and trying to get better. But basically, admitting it from the top down, we got tired of each other. And so we started to invite new guests. And when I got to Florida and I started to think more about it, you know, our old group just can't get there like they used to, family obligations, different jobs, it changed. And I said, okay, how can we help more young coaches who need to see not just how to recruit, but how to coach the game, how to coach the kids, how to be a mentor on and off the court, you know, the new wave, meaning how to handle social media, how to handle Generation Y, how to get a job, which is different. In the 80s, you interviewed, and certainly if Knight or Dean or Lute Olson called, you had a hell of a shot, but that's not the case anymore. Phone call is not going to get you the job unless it's a direct assistant of one of them. How you get the job now through search firms. So we try to bring in search firms to enlighten young guys how to do their job to the best of their ability, but at least learn how to put themselves in the best position to become a head coach someday. One last thing, Chris, and I mean, we can keep going as long as you want, because like I said, I got nothing on my plate anymore. One other thing about jobs in general now are the fits are so important now. But in my generation, if you lost your job, you had to work again. I mean, you really were worried. I mean, really worried. And thank goodness it is so profitable now at most levels that, especially at the 90 BCS schools, you're going to be okay. If you want to coach, you can coach. And I said this to one of my dearest friends who was one of the most loyal friends and assistant coaches I've ever been around, Scott Duncan, just yesterday. And I said, Scott, I hate what's going on too in some ways. But as much as I love the game, look, there's at least 250, 260 universities and coaches that are at least trying to do it the way it was meant to be. Kids going to school, kids getting degrees, kids learning how to play ball better. And you know what? A college game, you know, pep band, popcorn, the whole nine yards, a little beer here and there. I said, it's the 90 that can't afford to do that anymore because they price themselves out, be it either one and dones or their salary or the amount of money that their university has to grab. So here's three thoughts. Get them out of there. The only decision we have to make is what to do with those really good, 15, 18, Georgetown's, Gonzaga's, Villanova's, you know, the schools that don't have football. I haven't figured that out yet. Get those other guys out and let them play for a national championship. So that the 250, 260 do what was always almost designed to do. Even what those guys, the Dukes and the Kentuckys in the 60s and 70s, that they had to do it. You know, they went to school. That's number one, the breakaway. Number two is to make sure that if a coach in Division I is found guilty of a first offense, you know, a level one, that's the bad ones. He or his assistants, anywhere he wants the rest of his career, except Division I. He can go G League. He can go overseas. He can go NBA. He can go Division II. He can go Division III. He can go NAI. He can go junior college. He can go high school. Just not in Division I.
Ever.
And now, is love of the game more than love of the salary? And then the last suggestion is this idea that those 250 that are trying to do it the right way and have pretty good kids and pretty good talent, so they're not pirated, and they are being pirated now. I mean, every staff at the BCS level has at least one, sometimes two on their staff that are looking only for fifth-year transfers that can come in quickly or high-point talent at lower division schools that they can grab and get them to flee. So it could only benefit academics. Any transfer, sit out. But coach, the guy's done great academically. You know, this Kevin, whatever his name is, at the NCAA came up with this thing. Nothing. They've done great. Let him go immediately. Well, you know what? To get a master's at 99% of the places in this country, it takes more than 9 months. So have them sit out. Have them work on their game. Mentor the other young players. Continue their graduate performance and then play. What I think will happen, what I hope will happen, is the 260 solid as a rock Vermont's, Robert Morris's, Northern Arizona's will continue to love the game. They'll be on campus. They'll learn, they'll mentor, and hopefully they'll give back to the game. But they won't be pirated. Maybe an occasional transfer here and there. God bless them. But I know three very good college coaches who, and I know how those kids left, that left immediately from their mid-major program and went to such and such. It cost them their job. And I also read, I don't know if it's a fact, but I thought Seth Greenberg was the one that printed it, that over, I thought he said, over 300 young people that put their names in the transfer portal had nothing. They lost their scholarship. They didn't get picked up. They're out. I don't know what they do.
That's high.
It's really too bad. I mean, but anyways, Chris, I meant what I started with. You, Jen, the two young ladies, the way you've been able to put together love of game, obviously a very important way to teach the game, but the love of game of life, it resonates. And it's important, and people in the game have to continue to go down that road. You know, money changes a lot of people, but thank God in your case, you are who you are. And I more than appreciate this.
Well, I appreciate that, Coach. And again, being around people like yourself and Coach Driscoll and whatnot, like coaches when I was young that I didn't have a great idea of what being a Division I head coach or what being an important person in your community necessarily was. But you guys and Joe Razzo, one of my mentors at your master, I mean, all of you influenced so much my impression of coaching, but also my impression of what it meant to be a husband, to be a father while you're a coach. And it basically made it okay for me to feel comfortable to be both those things and not sometimes this media portrayal of what a coach has to be. And I would always have my daughters at practices. As you know, I always travel with my family whenever I attend clinics. So when we show up at the Florida clinic, we're showing up as a group and my daughters and wife are having an amazing time, just like I am being a part of this game. So it's been tremendous. And I can't thank you enough for everything that you've shown me over the year.
Well, I appreciate it. Like I said, I'm really enjoying spending this time that I really haven't spent with Pam these last 3-4 months. What's next? I don't know. Who knows? But, you know, maybe you go, you help a good friend 5-6 months a year. Maybe who knows what. But I got to be honest with you. The love of game and sort of the connection, the strong connection of love of game, but game of life as well, still to me resonates. And as frustrated as I get, but I understand the money involved, as frustrated as I get with some of the decisions that have been made collegiately, I still love that game and I miss it.
Awesome. Tremendous, tremendous to have you a part of the game, Bill. Thank you.
All right, brother. You take care. Thank you so much.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.